Welcome to the Republican Professor. I'm your host, Dr. Lucas J. Mather. We're getting back into the last part of Chevron, the case from 1984. So we're going to go through Roman numeral 7 and finish tonight, I believe. So strap in and we'll get started. Now, as I've said many times, I really enjoy printing them out and reading them. I've been doing the old Rush Limbaugh, paper shuffle like that. I enjoy having a hard copy that I can read. You might be different, but let's get to Google Scholar. Share my screen. Feel free to call me Sharon. I'm at Google Scholar. You go to case law, federal courts, and then you go to Chevron. It's the 1984 Supreme Court decision. So you'll see it right there. And we are in Roman numeral 7. So here we are. In this court, respondents expressly reject the basic rationable that has to be some kind of Scrivener's error there. The basic rationable of the Court of Appeals decision. It should be rationale. That's the worst one I've seen. That court viewed the statutory definition of the term source. Remember, we're talking about the definition of a term source, stationary source, in regulation. And Congress had not specifically defined it. It seemed like it might have two different definitions, a broader one and a narrower one. The Republicans wanted the narrower one only because it was clearer. Also, it was a little bit easier on, it was easier to comply with, so it was easier on business. Okay, remember that? All right. That court, let's go back. First line, Chevron. That court viewed the statutory definition of the term source as sufficiently flexible to cover either a plant-wide definition, a narrower definition covering each unit within a plant, or a dual definition that could apply to both the entire bubble and its components. Are you asleep yet? It interpreted the policies of the statute, however, to mandate the plant-wide definition in programs designed to maintain clean air and to forbid it in programs designed to improve air quality. I have to just laugh. Respondents place a fundamentally different construction on the statute. They contend that the text of the act requires the EPA to use a dual definition. No, it doesn't. If either a component of the plant or the plant as a whole emits over 100 tons of pollutants, it is a major stationary source. You see how complex that, how needlessly complex that is? Give me a break. But you know what? Let me riff here. I got to rip on the electorate here. Because the voters put up with this kind of crap. The voters are the ones that go, yeah, you should clean the air. You expect the government to do everything. You expect government, like Superman, to clean the air. And how are they going to do that? Well, you vote for congressmen who say, we're going to clean the air. And then they create some kind of agency that's supposed to clean the air. And they say, agency, you do, we're not going to define key terms and legislation, you do that. And the agency doesn't really do a very good job of it. Congress didn't do a good job. The agency's all over the map. And the next thing you know, people are losing their jobs because industry cannot make heads or tails of what the heck is going on with these regulations. And there's so many of them. And you got to comply, you have to hire these experts, and half time the experts don't even understand them. You got to go to court, and the court says one thing, and then a higher court says another thing. Guys, I'm just saying. It's the electorate. It's the electorate. Okay. All right. They thus contend that the EPA rules adopted in 1980, that's under Carter, a Democrat, insofar as they apply to the maintenance of quality of clean air, as well as the 1981 rules which apply to non-attainment areas, violate the statute. Statutory language. Let's get into some statutory language. The definition of the term stationary source in the statute refers to any building, structure, facility, or installation. Yeah, that's ambiguous. Any building, structure, facility, or installation. It could mean the whole thing, or it could mean a part of the thing. When your definition includes a part or the whole, that's definitely ambiguous, which emits air pollution. This definition is applicable only to NSPS program by the express terms of the statute. The text of the statute does not make this definition applicable to the permit program. Petitioners therefore maintain that there is no statutory language even relevant to ascertaining the meaning of stationary source in the permit program, aside from the part of the statute which defines the term major stationary source. We disagree with petitioners on this point. Remember, this is the U.S. Supreme Court. They're saying that they're disagreeing with Chevron here, who ends up winning. The definition in part of the statute, the section 302J, tells us what the word major means. A source must emit at least 100 tons of pollution to qualify, but it sheds virtually no light on the meaning of the term stationary source. It does equate a source with a facility. A major emitting facility and a major stationary source are synonymous under section 302J. The ordinary meaning of the term facility is some collection of integrated elements which have been designated and constructed to achieve some purpose. Moreover, it is certainly no affront to common English usage to take a reference to a major facility or a major source to connote an entire plant as opposed to its constituent parts. Basically, however, the language of this part of the statute, this is part of the law, not the regulation. 302, section 302J simply does not compel any given interpretation of the term source. And that's a key part of this here. Let me highlight that for those of you who are watching on YouTube. Okay. So using common English usage, but he's saying the statute simply does not compel one interpretation or the other. And okay, so what is that code for? It's code for that Congress screwed up. Congress didn't do its job. It did not define these key terms, which are huge. They're really important terms. You getting that? The Supreme Court is chastening, it's chiding Congress. Now, what do we do? What's the answer to this problem when Congress doesn't do its job? Well, respondents, that's the Natural Resources Defense Council, those are the Democrats. Respondents recognize that and hence point to a different statute, part of the statute, section 111A3. Although the definition in that section is not literally applicable to the permit program, it sheds as much light on the meaning of the word source as anything in the statute. As respondents point out, the use of the words building, structure, facility, or installation, notice the word or there. You see the word or? Okay. As the definition of source could be read to impose the permit conditions on an individual building that is part of a plant. See the problem? It could be the part or it could be the whole. And when your permit is writing on this, the part or the whole, well, which one is the permit writing on? Which one do you need to make sure is compliant? You see the problem here? You see the problem? Man, you guys, less regulation is a lot more easy to deal with here. We're not very good at this. We're not very good at this. As respondents point out, okay, so a word, where are we at? A word might have a character, may have a character of its own, not to be submerged by association. Here we're getting into statutory interpretation. On the other hand, the meaning of a word must be ascertained in the context of achieving a particular objectives. All right. Okay. And the words associated with it may indicate that the true meaning of the series is to convey a common idea. The language may reasonably be interpreted to impose the requirement on any discrete but integrated operation which pollutes. This gives meaning to all the terms. A single building, not part of a larger operation, would be covered if it emits more than 100 tons of pollution, as would any facility, structure, or installation. Indeed, the language itself implies a bubble concept of sorts. Right? The language itself implies a bubble concept of sorts. Well, Justice Stevens, it sounds like you're doing statutory interpretation to me. You're doing hermeneutics, as we call it, in the language of biblical history and literature. Each enumerated item would seem to be treated as if it were encased in a bubble. While respondents insist that each of these terms must be given a discrete meaning, they also argue that Section 111A3, that's another part of the statute that we're talking about before, defines source as that term is used in 302J. The latter section, however, equates a source with a facility, whereas the former defines source as a facility among other items. We are not persuaded that parsing of general terms in the text of the statute will reveal an actual intent of Congress. And you know what? That's the big issue right here. Is you got 435 people. What could possibly go wrong? They can't agree on these major controversial issues, at least enough to get over 50% to the president's signature. You got to get 50% bicamerally. You got to get them in 50% the exact same text in both chambers. That's really hard. Really hard on controversial things like this is, like cleaning the air. You might think it's easy to clean the air. Not really when the causes are in dispute and when some have to undergo much greater costs than others in that project. What could possibly go wrong? What Justice Stevens is saying in this opinion here in the for the court is he's saying Congress dropped the ball here. I mean, we're trying as judges. That's what this is what he's saying. We can't tell. We can't tell what the hell they're trying to say. We know full well that this language is not dispositive, the terms are overlapping, and the language is not precisely directed to the question of the applicability of a given term in the context of a larger operation. To the extent any congressional intent can be discerned from this language, it would appear that the listing of overlapping illustrative terms was intended to enlarge, rather to confine, the scope of the agency's power to regulate particular sources in order to effectuate the policies of the act. Now he's going to go to legislative history, which this is before Scalia got on the court. After Scalia got on the court, he was famous for just discouraging legislative history, use of legislative history. But this is 1984. He didn't come on the court until 1986. In addition, respondents argue that the legislative history and the policies of the act foreclose the plant-wide definition. Okay. So respondents, who are they? They're the Democrats, the National Reforest Defense Council. Chevron USA, basically code for Republican here. Okay. Respondents. So the Democrats argue that the legislative history and the policies of the act foreclose the clearer definition that the Republicans prefer. Okay. The bubble concept. And that EPA's interpretation is not entitled to deference because it represents a sharp break with prior interpretations of the act. And when he's saying that the respondents, the Democrats, argue that the legislative history clears all this up. The text is not clear, but the legislative history is. That's what they're saying. They're wrong, but that's what they're saying. And that the EPA's interpretation, well, what's this? That's Republican. The Republican interpretation. Because remember, 1984, Reagan is president. Who were The EPA works for Reagan. Reagan has Republicans running the EPA. Okay. So the Republicans are not entitled to deference because it breaks with prior interpretations. That is to say, Republican. That is to say, it breaks with Democrat prior interpretations of the act. Based on our examination, the court says, of the legislative history, we agree with the Court of Appeals that it is unilluminating. And Scalia would say, yep. The general remarks pointed to by respondents were obviously not made with a narrow issue in mind, and they cannot be said to demonstrate a congressional desire. Yeah, that's the problem with legislative history. It's just some guy speaking on the floor. I mean, if it's not in the text that passes bicamerally and is presented there to the president for signature, what are you talking about? Okay. Respondents argue that based on legislative history relies heavily on Senator Muskie's observation. See, it's just one guy. One of 100. Senator Muskie's observation that a new source is subject to, this requirement, but the full statement is ambiguous, and like the text of Section 173 itself, this comment does not tell us what a new source is, much less that it is to have an inflexible definition. We find that the legislative history as a whole is silent on the precise issue before us. It is, however, consistent with the view that the EPA should have broad discretion in implementing the policies of the 1977 amendments. More importantly, and I'm on page 863 now in the US reports, more importantly, that history plainly identifies the policy concerns that motivated the enactment. The plant-wide definition is fully consistent with one of those concerns, the allowance of reasonable economic growth, and whether or not we believe it most effectively implements the other, we must recognize that EPA has advanced a reasonable explanation for its conclusion that the regulations serve the environmental objectives as well. Okay, there's this language here. I want you to focus here because this is classic Chevron deference doctrine language. Okay, that when you have ambiguity that forecloses a judicial determination based on statutory construction, the ordinary canons of statutory construction, that the new doctrine here being recognized and advocated by the court is that they will now prefer to punt to agencies and what they think, as long as it's reasonable, for them to come up with the answer to the ambiguity. Because there's got to be an answer to it. Congress obviously didn't help. The agency's doing its best in the executive branch to fill in the blanks here. So this language here, we must recognize that the EPA has advanced a reasonable explanation for its conclusion. So they go, that's the bar. That's the bar is reasonability. It's a really low bar, especially as they're defining it. Indeed, its reasoning is supported by the public record developed in the rulemaking process, as well as by certain private studies. Our review of the EPA's varying interpretations of the word source, both before and after the 1977 amendments, convinces us that the agency primarily responsible for administering this important legislation has consistently interpreted it flexibly. Well, okay. That means that's code for the agency's going back and forth. Okay. Like a ping pong ball, depending on who's president. Okay. But at least there's some accountability to the voters. I'm not saying I believe that. I'm saying this would be the rationale of the court here. Okay. Now, so our review of the EPA's varying, so that there's consistent flexibility is what he's saying, which is means it's like a ping pong ball here, going back and forth. Not in a sterile textual vacuum, but in the context of implementing policy decisions in a technical and complex area. This is code right here. This language of implementing policy decisions is code for somebody else's president now. And there's a new policy decision that they're trying to shove into existing law. The law is ambiguous, and the Democrats interpret it one way before. Now the Republicans are interpreting it a different way later. Same law, different rules based on the law. And they wouldn't be able to do that if Congress did a better job making the law. To where the president couldn't do that. They couldn't go back and forth because the law would be so precise. I'm pounding on Congress here because remember, don't forget, this was overturned last year in 2024. Don't forget that. Okay? By Republicans. So, the fact that the agency has, from time to time, that's code for after an election, from time to time, changed its interpretation of the term source does not, as respondents argue, as the Democrats argue, lead us to conclude that no deference should be accorded to the agency's interpretation of the statute. An initial agency interpretation is not instantly carved in stone. On the contrary, the agency to engage in informed rulemaking must consider varying interpretations and the wisdom of its policy on a continuing basis. Moreover, the fact that the agency has adopted different definitions in different contexts adds force to the argument that the definition itself is flexible. Ooh, I don't like that. Particularly since Congress never indicated any disapproval of a flexible reading of the statute. Well, that's not because Congress approves of it being flexible. It's because it's really hard to get Congress to agree. Once it's out there, then they got other stuff to do, and they're not going to go back to this unless the voters make a big stink of it. And who the voters are not going to make a big stink of it unless they're losing money. And who's losing money? It's going to be a minority of people. You're not going to get the same oomph that you had for clean the air. Are you following me? You know what I mean, Vern? You know what I mean? I don't like that part. And I'm glad that that part is overruled, I'm hoping. We'll find out when we get to Loper Bright. Okay. Significantly, it was not the agency in 1980. Remember, Democrats were in charge then, but rather the Court of Appeals that read the statute inflexibly to command a plant-wide definition for programs designed to maintain clean air and forbid such a definition for programs designed to improve air quality. The distinction the court drew may well be a sensible one, but our labored review of the problem has surely disclosed that it is not a distinction that Congress ever articulated itself. Right? Yeah, that's kind of a problem right there. That's kind of a problem. Yeah. The distinction the court drew, remember that was Ruth Bader Ginsburg, may be a sensible one, but our labored review of the problem has surely disclosed it is not a distinction that Congress ever articulated itself, or one that the EPA found in the statute before the courts began to review the legislative work product. We conclude that it was the Court of Appeals rather than the Congress or any of the decision makers who were authorized by Congress to administer the legislation that was primarily responsible for the 1980 position taken by the agency. There's a lot here. There's a lot right here. Because you'll have to remember that the Court of Appeals is the DC Circuit, code for Democrat. Ruth Bader Ginsburg is writing the opinion, okay? And what the Supreme Court here is saying is that they're not saying it this way, but they're saying the Democrats on the lower court, the DC Circuit Court of Appeals, really is the one that came up with this choosing one of the prongs of the ambiguity. It wasn't the president, wasn't anybody working for the president in the EPA, and it wasn't Congress that did that. It was the court that did that. So there's this recognition that the court. The claim is that the court, the judges, the unelected judges are putting their view into this ambiguous policy preference and not Congress and not the executive branch that stands for an election, at least the president does. Okay, so arguments over policy, we're almost done. Arguments over policy that are advanced in the party's briefs create the impression that respondents are now waging a in a judicial forum a specific policy battle, which they ultimately lost in the agency and in the 32 jurisdictions opting for the bubble concept, but one which was never waged in the Congress. Such policy arguments are more properly addressed to legislators or administrators, not to judges. This is a key part right here. In case you're not sure what this means, the word policy, when it's said by a federal judge, is almost always in contrast to, well, I got to think about how I'm saying this here. It's oftentimes in contrast to law, but sometimes policy is law. So there's a couple different ways it could be used. When you're talking about constitutional law versus policy, that's definitely a distinction there. But oftentimes what the word policy means is like a regulation that you prefer within the existing law. But it can also just mean a new law that you want codified. But I think the way it's being used here is electorally tethered. That's what they're concerned about. They want policy to be addressed to legislators who stand for election or to administrators who work for those who stand for election, like a president, and who are confirmed by people who stand for election, like senators. Okay. Not to judges, because judges have lifetime tenure and it would be easy for judges to just insert their policy preference and then there's no accountability. In these cases, the administrator's interpretation represents a reasonable accommodation. There's the term reasonable, there's the reasonability here of manifestly competing interests and is entitled to deference. There we go. There's Chevron deference right there. It's tied to reasonability as a solution, a condition to the solution of an ambiguous language problem in the statute and regulation. The regulatory scheme is technical and complex. The agency considered the matter in a detailed and reasoned fashion. That's a really low bar, by the way. That what they're basically saying is you didn't contradict yourself, which is a pretty low bar. And the decision involves reconciling conflicting policies. Congress intended to accommodate both interests, but it did not do so itself on the level of specificity presented by these cases. Perhaps, I mean, let me put my thought in here right there. What business does Congress have legislating on this stuff if it doesn't do that? Just gonna let that float out there. Perhaps that body consciously desired the administrator to strike the balance at this level, thinking that those with great expertise and charged with the responsibility for administering the provision would be in a better position to do so. Perhaps it simply did not consider the question at this level. Probably that's what it was right there. And perhaps Congress was unable to forge a coalition on either side of the question. Yeah, probably. And those on each side decided to take their chances with the scheme devised by the agency. For judicial purposes, it matters not which of these things occurred. Judges are not experts in the field. Well, what does that matter? We're not talking about expertise, guys. We're talking about ambiguity in the language because Congress did not define the damn terms. You don't need expertise to know that the definitions there are all are a problem. They're problems with those definitions. They're not clear. You don't need an expert to know that. Okay. All right. Just, don't you gotta see through the BS here. The court is kind of shoveling a little bit of BS. And you might think this is maybe good. This is a good sign it was overturned. Judges are not experts and are not part of either branch, political branch of the government. The courts must, in some cases, reconcile competing political interests, but not on the basis of the judge's personal policy preferences. Well, I agree with that. I agree with that. Okay. In contrast, an agency to which Congress has delegated policymaking responsibilities. See that's a problem right there. Delegated policymaking responsibility. See, this is you gotta this sentence right here. Congress has delegated policymaking responsibilities. What in the world does that mean? Let's go to U.S. Constitution. Constitution, Article 1. All legislative powers herein granted shall be vested in a Congress. It doesn't say it's vested in, and by the way, those legislative powers, none of them, besides maybe you could say the necessary and proper clause, but I don't think it's necessary or proper. So the herein granted powers in Section 8 down there, if you scroll down, you scroll all the way down to Section 8. These are the powers. The Congress shall have the power. These are the herein granted powers. None of them include delegating a damn thing to the executive branch. You read Section 8, you won't find it. Okay? It doesn't include delegating legislative powers. So keep in mind the delegation of policy making is an issue here. An agency to which Congress has delegated policy making responsibilities may, within the limits of that delegation, properly rely on the incumbent administration's view of wise policy to inform its judgments. Okay, maybe. Maybe. Right? While agencies are not directly accountable to the people, the chief executive is. Well, aren't you kind of assuming the chief executive can fire these people? That's a big assumption. And it is entirely appropriate for this political branch of the government to make such policy choices. Resolving the competing interests which Congress itself is either inadvertently did not solve or intentionally left to be resolved by the agency charged with the administration of the statute in light of everyday realities. When a challenge to an agency construction of a statutory provision, fully, fairly conceptualized, really centers on the wisdom of the policy agency's policy rather than whether it is a reasonable choice within a gap left open by Congress, the challenge must fail. Really? It must fail? In such a case, federal judges who have no constituency have a duty to respect legitimate policy choices made by those who do. The responsibilities for assessing the wisdom of such policy choices and resolving the struggle between competing views of the public interest are not judicial ones. Our Constitution vests such responsibilities in the political branches. We hold that the EPA's definition of the term source is a permissible construction of the statute, which seeks to accommodate progress in reducing air pollution with economic growth. The regulations which the administrator has adopted provide what the agency could allowably view as an effective reconciliation of these twofold ends. The judgment of the Court of Appeals is reversed. Marshall and Rehnquist took no part. O'Connor took no part. Okay, so it's a 6-0 opinion, and it was overturned last year by Republicans. What do you think? What do you think, man? I'll tell you this. I'll tell you this. The fact that Stevens is writing this and that it was overturned is a good sign, because Stevens is, I don't like him. I don't like him. I don't like him. Well, anyway, thanks for joining me on the Republican Professor podcast. We're done with the Chevron deference case here, the main one. We're done with Chevron USA Inc. versus Natural Resource Defense Council et al., argued February 29th, 1984, decided June 25th, 1984. 467th volume of the U.S. Reports, page 837. That's 1984. The Republicans won, and then Republicans overturned this last year. So, what's going on with that? We'll get to that next time. Talk to you later.